You're listening to Around Comics, episode 259, brought to you by InStockTrades.com and Evangelion by Funimation. Chicago, this is Around Comics, the comic culture podcast, where each week a revolving panel of guests talk about everything in and around the world of comic books and comics culture. And Around Comics is normally recorded at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles, but for the fifth week in a row, we're coming to you from Challengers Comics and Conversation. It is located at 1845 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. If you are in the area, please drop by. We are going to be back at Dark Tower, but honestly, I just didn't want to carry all the equipment back.
So lazy.
Hey there, folks. I'm Christopher Niesman. Let me get you introduced to this new roundtable. First of all, as always, Mr. Tom Cater.
Hi.
Hi, Tom.
I like, it's nice, like a long table, like far away. You're like over there.
You like a glass booth. You like me being far away from you?
Being far away. If we could get like a glass partition.
It's our dream of all recording in different rooms.
Separate rooms, very slowly coming together here.
Yeah. All right. Next, you know him as the voice of Word Balloon. He is, of course, our good buddy, Mr. John Suntress.
Hello.
Hello, John.
Good to see everybody.
Yeah. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Happy Black Friday.
Yes.
Steely Dan is playing in my mind right now. I'm just thinking of the words Black Friday.
I assume all of you guys got up at like 5 this morning to go to Target and fight people for...
I got my $20 digital camera and my...
I did get up at 5 o'clock this morning, but it was because my dog was throwing up all over the floor from all the table scraps she had eaten the night before. It was like, well, should I go to Best Buy now?
Well, you mentioned that you cooked the turkey yesterday, so I suspect...
Hey, I'll have to call my parents and my wife's parents and find out if they had similar experiences this morning. I have a feeling I would have heard from them by now.
So. Chris, you made a bad
or
turkey.
Or maybe not.
Or maybe not. Yeah, I may be sworn off. Our next guest, back from popular demand. This is far and away one of our most popular guests on the show in the last year, or maybe ever. The amount of fan mail that I've gotten for Mr. Christian Alame has been off the charts.
Hey, Chris, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Christian. You are, of course, the...
That's his Luc Besson voice whenever he's in a Luc Besson movie.
No, but I heard the past podcast we did together. I thought my voice was a little too high-pitched.
We're modulator. All our voices are down.
Wolfman Jacques.
I have to think about our female audience, okay?
All right, fair enough.
So I'll speak like Batman.
Very good.
Christian, if you hadn't listened to the episodes that he was on with us before, he is, of course, the current inker on Green Lantern, working with Doug Mankey, and an outstanding artist in his own right. So, Christian, it is an absolute pleasure to have you back.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be back.
Did you enjoy your capitalist American holiday yesterday?
Absolutely. Yeah. Tryptophan. I'm still sleepy anyway.
Then any French turkey yesterday? Or?
No. Just typical American meal. Like, that was good, actually. That was pretty good.
Yeah. No Greek stuff on the menu?
No. No feta in the turkey.
Okay.
Because
Christian is also Greek and part of the Greek comic book contingent. So you got to acknowledge
it's like the Greek
that
mafia.
Half of, well, that's the truth. You got to acknowledge the French and Greek side.
When we did... The Death of Martian Hunter, like last year, Requiem, it was like Doug Mankey, myself, and Peter Tomasi. So it was the Greek squad. Every one of us had like...
Get that sucker edited by Christos Gage and your high octane then.
Did you celebrate 40 days afterwards too with a little memorial as Greek tradition or anything?
Yeah, okay. I'm far from tradition.
All right.
Like, fair
enough.
Stay away.
You know, I
smell the lamb coming from that book.
It's the truth.
I hosted this year, so I did all the cooking, and I live in a very Latino neighborhood here in Chicago, and anytime my dad comes up to the neighborhood, we go out to dinner there in the neighborhood, and it's usually a taqueria or some sort of Mexican restaurant. And I told him, it's like, hey, we're gonna host Thanksgiving this year. You guys come on in. He's like, all right, we're not having no damn turkey tacos though.
Turkey tacos.
There better not be any goddamn tortillas anywhere near
that salsa.
Turkey.
I don't want any salsa as an appetizer either. Damn it.
It's like, I'm gonna put some sausage in the dressing. It's like, ain't gonna be none of that chorizo stuff.
It's gonna be American sausage. Chorizo.
Well, before we jump all the way in here, I want to remind everyone that this episode of Around Comics is brought to you by InStockTrades.com, where waiting for the trade has never been easier. InStockTrades.com is your source for trade paperbacks, deluxe hardcovers, omnibus editions, absolute editions, essentials, showcases, and more, all at great discounted prices. And remember that all orders over $50 do, in fact, ship for free. And, Tom, are we going to do our book club? Are you all set?
I'm not done with the book yet.
Okay, next time.
Like three quarters through, so by next time I should be all set.
So all you folks out there that have yet to read Hellblazer, Dangerous Habits, this is your last call. You can pick that up in stock for 47% off the cover price. It can be yours for the low price of $7.94. And really for less than $8, you know, you can't afford not to pick that up.
It's we'll see when we talk about it.
Are you the three quarters that you're through, are you enjoying it? The last quarter. It's slow build, and then I really did like the end of it. So
okay.
I think I was right where you are.
It's a seminal John Constantine story.
All right.
John's going to take you to school.
No, I'm just saying it is. No, and I can appreciate that it is kind of a slow burn, but the end it's one of the best Constantine stories, I think.
Yeah, we will talk about it at length, but
John always loves the cancer stories in comics. I gravitate to cancer stories.
Is that the one where the devil gives him cancer and all that? Like, I've read that a long time ago. That was great.
Spoilers.
That's right off the bat.
It's an old book. Yeah, of course. No, it is. And it's
that was a good one. I remember that story.
It's good. So we're
gonna
humbling
me.
All right. Well, you know, actually, before we started recording, Christian and Tom and I were having a kind of a fun conversation about covers, and we don't really talk about covers that much, or the history of covers. And I think the conversation started, we were talking about some of the Green Lantern stuff that you and Doug are working on, and you guys started kind of riffing, talking about some of the old Silver Age cover. So, you know, if you want to elaborate on what we were talking about.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like I do often, you know, because I'm thoughtful, I guess.
With that accent.
Yes.
Do you think with a French accent, or do you think in French?
Like, I think in French, actually, but it depends what I'm thinking about. If I'm thinking about, like, my ex-wife, I think in Greek. If I'm thinking, it's true. If I'm thinking about you guys, which thankfully never happens, then that would be in English. You know, language is associated with different subjects.
That's interesting.
And covers. I was a few days ago looking online at like old covers, like old Marvel covers and DC like Silver Age stuff.
Okay.
And the difference with today's covers is really striking. You get like a whole story. It's over dramatic, but it's so well put together that it absolutely works. You cannot resist these old covers. We were talking with Chris before like about like this classic Spider-Man cover, John Romita probably, where he's like walking away and he's got like his costume in the trash bag, you know, like, and he's
Spider-Man
like,
no more.
Yeah, that's it. And
the end, question mark.
I remember a wonderful cover. I think it might have been like Daredevil 20. I'm not even sure. It's above a gray cityscape and you get Daredevil and Spider-Man, I believe, like flying above like that. And it's just a striking cover, like just beautiful stuff. And there's almost like an expressionistic approach to these covers that's been lost today, I think. Like, that's for the most part.
Well, it used to be that you'd look at the cover and you'd be like, oh, how did that happen? Or, is, you know, because there's a portion of the, you know, rarely do I pick up a comic. Like, I'm looking at Brave and the Bold, number 29, and it's got Brother Power, the Geek, and Batman. And there's not a point where I look at it and go, oh, how is this, you know.
How do they get in this situation?
I read that. It was a teaser. It either acted as a teaser to the story, or especially at DC, a lot of times, and especially more in the anthology books, they would draw the cover and then say, write a story around that. I know that was a big Julie Schwartz edict.
You don't know that, you see? That's that reminds me of the stories about like guys buying sci-fi books back in the 60s just because Frazetta had done the cover. You know, that was the only selling point.
Absolutely.
Well, there is a lot. There's a couple of Flash stories, actually. They used to only come up with the covers first, and then they'd have to make up the story behind the cover. And there's a famous cover of the Barry Allen walking away from a tree in the Flash costume is like nailed up on the tree with a with a piece of paper saying "I quit." I mean, which I don't think is like the best way to resign. Just to like, you know, like now, who's gonna go by this tree?
The coyotes know that the Flash isn't fighting anymore.
It's an evocative image, and you look at it and you go, "Oh, I wonder what happens." And they actually both John Broome and Robert Kaniger wrote stories for that cover. And 1 month they ran the story that John Broome did. And then through probably some situation where they just didn't have another story, they're like, all right, we'll do the Robert Kaniger version of how that story came out the next
month.
Had
they done the same cover today instead of like, I quit, it would have been like, I hereby tend my resignation. Like, effective immediately.
So I quit
yours
now.
Truly, the Flash.
Well, and I've heard that the explanation why covers today aren't as connected to the story, it's because of previews,
exactly.
And they need to kind of put those images out first before really having the story together, I guess.
It is true. No, a lot of times it's still the case with Green Lantern now. although Doug, now they give him a general idea about like what's going to be, you know, like, okay, on this cover, like the last one, 48 that just came out, it's like, okay, we need the Blue Lantern against Blue Lanterns against the Orange Call. But a lot of times you're just like, okay, can you come up with a cover? And sometimes you don't even know what the story is about. And you're like, okay, you know, give me an idea. And the guy is like, okay, we're going to have this guy against this guy. And so you come up with whatever you can, but you have to stay non-committal, basically, because you don't know what's going to happen.
You can't have one character like killing the other character.
Yeah,
you can't have Hal, you know. You can't have Hal, nailing his ring to a tree saying, exactly. "I quit."
I hereby tender my resignation.
I also liked how there were like signature styles for both Marvel and DC covers, and it really was a handful of people. Like Murphy Anderson was pretty much the common factor in a lot of DC Silver Age covers, whether it was over Kurt Swan or
guys
over Infantino.
You used to have like Infantino and Nick Hardy and
Neil
Adams. Part of their major function was they would do the majority of the covers for all, you know, all the, you
for
know,
the line,
for a bunch of
for the entire, yeah,
to this day, when
Joe Cooper, too.
To this day, when I think of Green Lantern, the first images that come to mind are like Gil Kane and Neil Adams. I still remember these covers as if it was yesterday, as if they had just come out. And these stories, especially the Neil Adams ones, have been reprinted 1,000 times with various covers. I still remember the originals ones. Sure. I just project them onto the book.
That's, certainly with the Flash covers, I feel that way about Infantino and Murphy Anderson and all the guys that, you know, the majority it seems like they were Infantino. Am I right? I mean, you're the one that's been like pouring
for the
over.
Flash ones? For the Flash, yeah. Well, when he drew it, he did the covers for a long time. And then when he stopped drawing it, he did it for a while after that, and then it was Nick Carty, and Ernie Chan, and then Rich Buckler, and Kubert did a few, and Neil Adams did a few. And
I always love seeing Kubert, especially doing like those characters that he isn't known for doing the interiors on. Like, you've got Superman Kubert covers.
Oh, I remember.
And I think that's really interesting.
The ones that strike me more, curiously, it's not even a Hawkman or like all that stuff. It's Unknown Soldier.
His war stuff is
great. Great covers.
Absolutely.
All the war stuff was just beautiful.
Yes.
Don't talk too much about the 60s. Tommy's still afraid of the 60s Superman, the mean Superman.
Superman is a dick cover.
Such a cruel Superman.
Classic, absolutely. The other thing, too, is on the Marvel side, you mostly had Kirby doing a lot of covers. And then it's funny how during the Steranko craze, that literally there are so few interior books that he did, but he did a ton of covers.
True.
And immediately, I think the feeling was, obviously, that was the entry point to get people to buy the book. So I think the artists were more valuable as cover artists than they were interior
artists. One of the most striking covers from Steranko that I remember is like the X-Men issue from the month of my birth, actually, which is X-Men 50. And you have like Lorna Dane, like Polaris, like floating like that in green with beautiful colors.
Cover.
And that's like the November 68 when I was born. So that's just like beautiful.
But there's also like a weird function with the idea of spoilers now, too. You know, like one of my favorite books is The Walking Dead, but no Walking Dead cover is anything more than a generic image of someone being sad or like sitting down because so many people wait to read the trade on that book that you can't have anything on a cover because the covers go out everywhere, you know, and like if there's anything that's even remotely close to like a spoiler. In fact, there's been a few where like it looks like someone's being killed that doesn't get killed. You know, like mm-hmm. the cover almost serves as like
they're
a misdirection.
They're even careful with the ads for Walking Dead. I mean, they went probably farther than they had before in this last ad campaign the dead hunt. Don't stalk, the yeah. dead don't hunt, which you know tied into that last storyline. And so they're really careful even with the advertisements. So I think they understand that book so well in that it is a trade driven book. And as we get into that, but that's another thing. You know, as we see more trades coming out, I think there's a lot of trades that will repurpose like the first issue of a title, but you're starting to see a lot more original covers that are done just for the trade dress for stuff, which I think is kind of nice. So
I think lately too at Marvel there's been some really good covers. Scotty Young, our friend,
Scotty's
has been
awesome
really
job.
Doing some yeah. very iconic covers. That Marvel Adventures Armor Wars, the retelling of that story, I had no interest in it, but man, I'll tell you, those Scotty covers made me buy the books because they really, I mean, he had that classic Hamlet Last Poor Yorick, I Knew Him Well kind of image of Stark holding, or I guess, okay, sorry, for nerds, that would be Darth Vader holding the C-3PO.
Yeah, the C-3PO head.
Well, speaking of, Scotty just did the cover for Marvel Adventures Spider-Man number 57.
Was it him and Deadpool? Actually, I saw it. It was an amazing Spider-Man.
Chris Somney did interiors, and I need to pick that up today because I hear great stuff about Marvel Adventures Spider-Man, and I don't read it on a regular basis, and I hear that it really is a fun Spider-Man book. So
anyone know what the proportion of comics produced back then, like say in the late 60s, was compared to today? I'm looking at the rights here in Challengers, and there's like, you know, like it seems like maybe like a 200 comics at least, like on the racks.
You did have the other publishers back in the Silver Age too, like Dell and Gold
but
Key.
DC and Marvel didn't put out 15 books a week. You know,
that's true.
I mean, when I get like the comp list like every month, like for a single month, it sounds like we get probably like 70 comics, 80. I don't know. I have no idea.
I think it is around 80, isn't it? Including Vertigo and
Wildstorm.
I think it is like 80.
Everything. That's huge.
And I think Marvel's at 60.
Yeah, but you got to look at distribution. I mean, there was a time whenever there weren't stores that were dedicated to having walls and walls of comics. You go to a drugstore or a Stop and Shop, and it's like they'd have 20 books there, and that was it.
Well, then also the scheduling. Not every book was monthly back in the Silver Age. Not only did you have bi-monthly books, but you had eight issues a month or 8 issues a year.
Wow.
Semi, how did they call that? I don't even remember what they called it.
They purposely didn't mention it until they switched it to monthly, and then they said, now it's monthly.
I don't know if it's the same in English. We got like, if it's like twice a month, it's bimensual. If it's like every 2 months, it's bimestrial. So I don't
know. That sounds like a women's product that you'd be taking.
Yeah, well,
you know, all right. You know, like, interesting. Which aisle is that in?
You know, it's a sensual job anyway.
It's never comes.
Sensual job.
This portion of Around Comics is brought to you by Evangelion from Funimation. Imagine having Dr. Frankenstein as your father. Your classmate and fellow pilot is a partial clone of your dead mother, and she's hot. You've been forced by your father to pilot a giant living robot named Eva Unit 1 to fight deadly creatures called angels from destroying the planet. And to top it off, you have raging teenage hormones, and it's the end of the world if you screw up. No pressure. The Evangelion 1.01 You Are Not Alone movie is the complete rebuild of the groundbreaking sci-fi giant robot anime. Otaku USA magazine writes, "Evangelion reminds us of what anime can be by having us all flex our otaku muscles, yet always satisfies our basis needs for cute girls and mecha. Watch the first 8 minutes of the movie at www.funimation.com/Evangelion. Evangelion 1.01, You Are Not Alone, available now on DVD. Well, Hey, since we have Christian here, we should probably talk a little Green Lantern. What's going on with Blackest Night? As that continues to be a pretty outstanding event in my opinion. I'm still having a lot of fun with it. I was afraid that I was going to get a little bored with especially with the crossovers of okay, well here's the next dead character showing up to torment these people, and we're kind of starting to enter that any of the one shots or like the Teen Titans just came out, and there was the Blackest Night Outsiders as these one shots. And
but anytime you can bring back Vibe,
yes,
Justice, you know, anytime you can bring back the Puerto Rican breakdancer or anything, you have to
how did you like that?
I haven't finished it yet. I bought it and I flipped through and I was like, oh, it's Vibe. I'm like,
I gotta say, JT Krull doing the Titans, he did an excellent job on that Blackest Night miniseries, and mm-hmm. I was very happy to see him on the monthly because I think that was one of the better surprising spinoff.
Very good mini.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, and I really was surprised because it was one that I didn't have much interest in, and then I read those three issues, and I thought it was great and left the story in a very interesting point.
I haven't read any of the tie-ins yet. I think I'm going to wait until everything is done mm-hmm. and pick a reading order and try to get everything at once. Even though I'm working on it, it's like I don't remember everything. And sure. I don't read them also in a timely fashion because I'm working on a story that's obviously not published yet. At the same time, I get the completes late as well, and people online are talking about stuff I haven't read yet because I get the completes like much later than the books come out.
Yeah, focus
so
on doing them.
It's a bit confusing, and I want to keep focused exactly on what we're doing with Doug. So I'm kind of waiting the end of it to reread everything, like mm-hmm. You know, like, and just like get it in. Like I did the same thing with Final Crisis last year. With all the stuff we've been working on, like Superman 3D, like Superman Beyond, like Death of Martian Manhunter, and the miniseries itself of Final Crisis, I had to wait until everything came back, like in trade paperbacks and that. I sat down one day and read everything, and then I started to understand what it was about. Because before that, I was like, okay, I don't know. I'm just going to
ink. Yeah. I just got to ink.
That's it.
You can't call and say, I don't understand what happened on this page.
But so are you hip to what's happened at Green Lantern Corps? That and I think we're far enough away from it that we can talk about it now.
Yeah, it's fine.
Well,
I
haven't got the issue yet. If you're talking about Kyle Rayner, I didn't get the issue yet. I'll probably get it like next week or like the following week. So I've read about it online, but I have not read the book itself. Okay. That's why it's confusing. I try to not think about it too much, forget a bit about it. So next year, like whenever it is, like I pick up finally everything is done, I can enjoy it.
Like, you'll be like, oh, that book I worked on was
but
pretty
I
good.
But I got a huge spoiler for Blackest Night. I am like authorized to speak about it here, so it's a first. It was all a dream.
it's all a dream. There's one. It's like the end of Saint Elsewhere. Lantern staring into a snow globe.
How Jordan wakes up in Edwards Air Force Base
in the shower.
Like,
in the shower, he had Patrick Duffy moment.
Yeah, cowgirl comes out. Hey, how you doing?
I ate too much turkey yesterday. You know,
the entire DC universe is a dream.
No Thai food after 3 a.m.
You know, I have been pretty impressed that you can read just Blackest Night and you can get what's going on. You can read Blackest Night and Green Lantern, and obviously that expands the story for you. Same thing with Green Lantern Corps, and you can kind of just you can measure how into it you want to be.
Absolutely.
And they've done a really nice job that the main story is in the main title, and then the main mainstream story, you know, with Green Lantern expands off of it. And then if you want to pick up the tie-ins, you can. You didn't have to read Outsiders
or
last
Batman.
Week.
Even Batman and Superman were not necessary.
You know, I think the only one that has had maybe the biggest consequences is the Teen Titans.
I would, and isn't that surprising?
Yeah, yeah.
That's one that actually has a chunk of the story that is interesting, and
it's like, wow, that's kind of a big revelation. Dove, the new Dove, the female Dove, she is apparently one of the only non-Lantern characters.
I don't want to hear that. La 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 la.
Don't spoil it for him.
Well,
he hasn't read it yet.
No, it's all right. I just think we're assisting to the, after a very long gestation, the birth of the yearly event mm-hmm. as an art form unto its own. In other words, it seems to me like it all started years ago with the annuals. Then the annuals started to interact with one another, and that created a small event. Then the events themselves got bigger and had like tie-ins and implications on other in other stories, other titles. And it seems to me after all these tryouts, like I always stayed away from big events, like mm-hmm. for the most part. And now I think with the Final Crisis last year, it started to get more interesting. They really like they pay a lot more attention than they used to. And I think Blackest Night might be the first event that completely works for me. That in other words, that's really an achievement unto its own. And it's like a new art form. It's like something that now you can expect, I suspect, every year from major publishers. And they're getting better at it.
It only took them about 10 or 15 years. In fairness, it
was an organic process. And also, it sounds like talking to all the people that have been behind a lot of these events that there was always resistance from pockets of creators who were forced to participate mm-hmm. and maybe didn't give their best effort. Well, and then it seems now there's a better chance of, at least on the Marvel side, and I don't know about the DC side, where creators can either opt into an event or opt out. And yes. I think that's a smart move.
And or now you get invited in, basically, and it's kind of an honor, you know, like
sure.
Before that, like when you were given an annual to do, it was kind of like, all right, they're giving you like the worst
crap
stuff.
Job.
You know, it was considered to be like, you know, it's just an annual. Nobody cares really. And like. I hated it even though I'd never had a Thanksgiving as a child.
I hated the idea that it could possibly happen.
Do you guys have any other holidays in France like Thanksgiving? Just an excuse
Bastille
to
Day? Yeah, is that a big deal?
Get the family together and eat.
No, Bastille Day is not even as big a deal in France as, like, say, Independence Day is here.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, people celebrate it. You get like a huge military parade on the Champs-Élysées. The jets are flying above, blah, blah. But nobody cares much. I mean, you know, just like
it's... Do families get together on that day and just hang out?
No. Okay. You just like watch the défilé on TV, the military défilé. I wait for the planes personally, then I turn the TV off. I especially don't want to hear the speech of the president or like, you know, it's just like, all right, thank you. You know, like... Christmas is the same as here. So it's like other celebrations which are not necessarily official, like New Year's Eve or like stuff like that. But no, there's no Thanksgiving. It's really a typical, by definition, American holiday.
Sure.
And there is no Halloween, although they tried, like, the past 10 years to introduce it in France. And mainly it came from, like, the big department stores because they figured could sell a lot of stuff, like little pumpkins and all that. So there was a little craze for a while, for, like, 3 years, and then it kind of came down again. So,
a reasonable place.
Like Love Day on The Simpsons.
So let me get something straight. Is Thanksgiving about, like, when the first pilgrim came on the East Coast, like, somewhere like New England, like, mm-hmm. their first year, their colony was failing, so basically they were starving to death. The Indians came and fed them, and then the next year they killed the Indians or some such?
It's
who's thanking who here? You know, I can't just, like...
That's the grade school nutshell.
Good, yeah,
did you guys break out the traditional Scarlet Fever blankets that we have in my house? I was going to say,
somebody tears that last chapter out of the book, though, when they try and tell it to us in grade school. They don't mention that next year they killed the same Indians they broke bread with.
I don't want to get into dangerous territory, but you don't hear many people mentioning, like, the Bible and speaking about incest or things like that, okay?
That's but it's usually in there.
It's all over the place.
Yeah, damn right.
Had to repopulate after
this
Sodom
book
and
is
Gomorrah.
Filthy. Yeah.
This is so horrifying.
Thanksgiving is actually started after the Civil War, during the Civil War. That's an Abe Lincoln holiday.
I heard the other day that on the radio that FDR wanted to change the date, and he did for a few years. Of Thanksgiving, he wanted to boost business, so he decided, I forgot exactly what it was, that it would be every year on the 25th or something like that.
Oh, he had a very specific day in mind.
A very specific day in mind, and there was such a popular reaction that he retracted very, very quickly.
All right,
like,
I fucked up, we'll put it back.
How did they have Black Friday? How were you supposed to go shopping?
You know,
back
honestly, that would be interesting to find out when Black Friday
speaking of Black Friday, I just wanted to mention to our listeners that today the podcast is free for them, but starting next week, they can send checks to Christian Alani.
He's co-opted the podcast.
Next week, the price doubles. and all checks are
two
sent
times
to,
zero.
Yes. So it's double the free price.
Still for free. I wanted to mention
if you put enough zeros, does it amount to something at some point? Is it like very small rocks? Do they float?
I was promised there'd be no math today. I have no idea.
Turns into a math podcast. Did you guys read The
Punisher?
Yes, Punisher indeed, sir.
Frankenstein. What'd you guys think?
I loved it. I mean,
Chris, what do you think?
I enjoyed it exponentially more than Punisher the List, which I thought was kind of a goofy Punisher story.
I respectfully disagree.
I thought Romita's art was great in that, but this was just a buttload of fun.
When I read it, I enjoyed it, but I couldn't help but think of like, because in my head, when I think of someone who's really into the Punisher, mm-hmm. who's like really into the Punisher, this must have been their worst nightmare of what would be like as Punisher gets turned into Frankenstein.
John and I had a nice conversation about this.
Yeah, well, and I know that this was something too that I listened to on 11 o'clock comics mm-hmm. and agreed with Vince and kind of felt bad for Jason, who admitted that he's kind of jaded and the way that the List ended, he's like, well, you know he's going to come back. And it's like, well, of course he's going to come back. But first on the List, I thought it was great. I thought it was very dramatic. It has to stand on its own, and it did. And now we've got this great right turn that, as you say, must drive Punisher fans crazy. But what do you do with the Punisher in the 616 universe when you already have an excellent Max book that gives you the straight-up crime? I think we saw in the 90s what happened when there were too many books that were the same with the Punisher.
They turned Punisher black.
They did that. They turned him into an angel.
I think that is the genesis of the reaction to this, is that we as comic book fans have a tendency of being cynical and jaded. I know it's shocking, but we've seen this character really mishandled in the past, and it's like, oh God, okay, well they've killed him, and now they're gonna sew him back together and make him into a monster.
But do you think, like, in 10 years, you know, the punchline about the Punisher being black is everyone's always like, they turned the Punisher black, and then what a stupid idea. Do you think in 10 years, someone will look back and be like, they turned Punisher Frankenstein.
It was that or gay, and they figured that.
Punisher.
These are the two directions we can go with the Punisher.
Well, it seems like sometimes, you know, it seems to me these are always editorial decisions, and they're not always the most original, okay?
But it's a grounded street
however,
character.
However, I didn't read this one, but I saw, like, the advertising I was reading. Actually, I read, like, lately the I don't read comics, and especially not Marvel, since I get all the DC for free, but I did read, like, the Marvel's Project, like the three first issues, which are really enjoyed, and in it was like a commercial for that, and I saw the commercial, I'm like, Franken Punisher, whatever they call him, and then I saw, like, Tony Moore does it, and I love Tony Moore. I was like, okay, that should be fun, you know.
With the Punisher, we have a couple different ways that we can go here. Actually, three different ways. You've got Punisher Max, which I absolutely love, the Garth Ennis Punisher Max. We had a very grounded street level crime and military comic,
continuing the capable hands of Jason Aaron and Steve Dillon. Currently.
Oh, Swarczynski, I think, worked on it.
Oh, Dwayne did a great job. Absolutely.
So you have a very real world Punisher, which appeals to a whole set of Punisher fans. And then in the Marvel 616, there's two ways you can go. You can ground him with Daredevil and make him more of a street level 616 character, or you can do what Rick and Tony are doing, and that is embrace everything that is crazy fun about superhero comics and say, you know what, we're going to team him up with the League of Monsters.
Well, and how does the Punisher react to this kind of craziness as opposed to a powered
What is
hero?
616? Is that the area code?
That was created by Alan Moore. It's like all the parallel universes, like Earth 1 and Earth 2.
Okay, yeah.
And supposedly the Earth, the proper Marvel universe happens is 616.
Okay,
and it was 1961 of June, which is when I believe Fantastic Four debuted, and that's why it has that number of 616.
All right, so 616 is the parallel one or the original one?
That's the main stream, Marvel.
They got two universes,
Well, technically, I guess you got the Ultimate Universe now. So
they're poor.
Just like, we got 52, all right?
Well, but they have 616, supposedly, so you never know.
Well, you, and you they can have other, as many as you need.
So they say. Yeah,
so, they say. But I do like, I think it's a great idea. And also, as you were saying about the Daredevil comparison, that's why Ultimate Daredevil doesn't work. Daredevil is a street-level, realistic character that to ultimize him, it what do you do? It's already real world. Yeah. And I think the Ultimates the Ultimate Universe was an attempt to make it a more real current universe and stuff.
Well, actually, about the Ultimates, are they included in these different universes? Because
they are in the Ultimate. The Ultimates are in the Ultimate Universe. They're the Avengers of the Ultimate Universe.
All right. So what number is that? Is there a number?
There's not a number.
There's no number. I thought maybe they put the Ultimate in one of the parallel universes or like something like that.
It is, and that's actually now we're going to get really nerdy.
You wouldn't want that to happen on a comic book podcast.
There has been kind of a string of connection between the Ultimate Universe and the 616 universe, and that's the Marvel Zombies.
I was going to say, then there's the Zombie Universe. Yeah. There's a third.
My
universe.
Zip code is 60626, so I vote for like Ultimate being 606.
Well, and the what if stories initially were suggested to be alternate worlds, because that first story was what if, you know, Spider-Man had joined the FF like he had been tried to do in that first Spider-Man 1, and the Watcher goes through this whole, there are various worlds where this happened and this happened.
It's so, just Marvel just never really embraced it like DC has to really have them interact with, you know, they have, you know, at certain points. But Tom, how did you like the Punisher 11?
Oh, I did. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it, but the whole time I was reading it, I thought, God, there's got to be some Punisher fan out there who's
clearly
like going to.
But again, I don't think it was so much. Ultimately, yeah, I do think that they messed with the character in goofy ways in the 90s. But I think where the problem was, it was just an oversaturation of too many books telling the same type of stories at the same time. I mean, I think a lot of those Mike Barron and Bill Reinhold Punishers are fantastic. Stephen Grant did excellent stuff. Chuck Dixon, all of these guys did wonderful 80s and 90s Punisher stories. It just there was just too much of the same thing.
And it doesn't hurt to mix things up. And like I said, I mean, there's a Punisher Max title out right now that Jason is writing, which is fantastic.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I mean, Punisher fans, there always is going to be a Punisher out there for you.
And this series, I think from the start, when it started with Punisher War Journal, had already kind of like made a step and say, okay, no, this is the Punisher in the 616 universe.
We're going to be a little goofy.
Goofy shit's going to happen.
And that's fine. So.
When I was a Frankenstein. I also wanted to mention, while we were talking about Blackest Night, there's actually there's quite a few books the last couple of weeks I really enjoyed. But before we get too far away from Blackest Night, which we should because we've talked about it endlessly, it's Superman Batman number 66 by Scott Collins, which was surprisingly very, very good.
He wrote and drew it. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
He had done the Solomon Grundy miniseries, which I enjoyed the art. I thought you could see that Scott Collins hadn't written a lot of stuff because there's some writing things that kind of lost me a little bit. But this story involves Solomon Grundy, who was killed by the DC Frankenstein at the end of his miniseries, is brought back to life by a Black Lantern, runs into Bizarro, who he became friends with, and they run into Man-Bat, and it's beautiful Scott Collins art. I just love his art, and for whatever reason, I love his art on the DC stuff more than I did the Marvel stuff. So you get all the awesome Scott Collins art. You know, he draws a fantastic Bizarro. He draws a great Man-Bat as well.
Well, you've got a lot of affection for Scott Collins because the great, you know, run that he did with Jeff Johns on The Flash.
But if you if you love his art, you will really enjoy this story. It features since we're talking about Frankensteins and Frankencastles, it has the DC Universe Frankenstein in it running around. It's a real simple story. It's not like overly complicated and having to understand what's going on. Just know that Bizarro thinks that Solomon Grundy's his friend. And now he isn't. So you have you have all the Black Lanterns, you know, taunting people. You can get Solomon Grundy taunting Bizarro, which
me, I'm sad to learn this.
I'm happy to learn this.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
But it was I picked it up on a whim because I love Scott Collins' art, and it was very good.
You know, invariably I'll pick up a Superman Batman just when I like feel like reading something else, and I'm never disappointed. And I have to say that. you know, Jeff Loeb had that, and Ed McGuinness and others had that wonderful start to the series. It kind of wandered a little bit. He left the book at 25. And I honestly think that for the most part, I'd say an 80% portion of those books since have been excellent stories. And I'm very happy that they've moved to the one-shot format because I think it works great. And I think that's what made World's Finest the book that it was when it was excellent.
This one's concluded in the next issue.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This one's a two.
Oh, I appreciate you telling me that. Well, because I haven't had a chance to read that one yet.
Well, they've done a lot of that. They've had some really nice two-part stories in that.
I think it works better because I think there's enough six-issue arc stories. And also, if you're missing – now, obviously not in the case of this story, but for the most part, if you're missing Bruce Wayne and Clark Kent, that's where they are. Working together, and you know, especially Bruce Wayne right now. If you miss Bruce Wayne, you can find him most of the time.
It's kind of like Punisher, you know. If you're a Batman, Superman fan, well, you know, there's always going to be a version out there for you.
So. Christian, where do you stand on Bizarro talk? I know Bizarro talk bothers people. Some people quite a bit.
I don't know. Bizarro, I think, is as good as like how he's written. He's one of these characters that has no greatness built in, I think. It's it can be very easily awkward and kind of like...
Should it always be backwards talk? Should it always be backwards talk?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, like, he's Bizarro.
He should never actually say, in my opinion.
You have to go all the way. Like, it's like the demon without rhymes. You know, like, you cannot do that. You write the demon, you have to have the rhymes, you have to have everything.
One of my favorite
Bizarros... I got a trivia question for Caters real fast. Who is the father of, or not the father, but who really wrote the bulk of the great Silver Age Bizarro stories?
Oh.
Come on, Tom. He knows.
It's one of these forgotten writers
that did finally get the Finger Award a couple years ago. I want to say 07. Alvin Schwartz.
Huh.
Alvin Schwartz, big caretaker of
the
a lot of
Finger
the great...
Award?
Yeah, exactly.
I thought everyone in comics got the Finger Award.
It's Bill Finger.
Yeah, I know.
But also, and it was suggested by Arnold Drake to kind of give the finger to the comics industry for not acknowledging him.
Finger, it's just like, here, you get the finger, buddy.
Yeah, I think that's acknowledged as being part of the award.
Absolutely.
You're in comics.
Well, yeah, that too. But also,
congratulations for being screwed over.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for ignoring him for far too many years. We're here to correct that. So there you go.
One of the books that's come out recently that we have not had a chance to talk about yet is the launch of First Wave is Batman Doc Savage Special number one. It's written by Chicagoan Brian Azzarello, and the art on this was done by Phil Noto, even though I believe Rags Morales is going to be doing
he'll be doing the main series. There are going to be offshoots. Go ahead.
You probably understand what's going on with First Wave and are probably way more excited about this than just about all of us. So explain a little bit about what First Wave
John
is.
John is trembling. I can feel the energy coming off of him. Look at him.
All right.
Relax.
This is what it is.
These
are a handful of Street and Smith pulp heroes that Brian has created a very special world. I mean, he's made it clear in the conventions. If you haven't heard about it, it's a timeless Earth where the best elements of the 20th and 21st century are all together. There are cars with runny boards and Tommy guns alongside the internet and cell phones.
Yeah.
And
that was a little weird. I was like, whoa, okay. You just have to just kind of say, okay, this is the world.
And Batman's career is literally in its first months.
Mm-hmm.
And in this first one-shot that
he uses guns.
He does, much like, and as Brian points out, Batman did in Detective Comics long before there was a Batman first issue, or, you know, first issue of Batman.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is the 1938 archetype of Batman, the original idea of the story, next to non-superpowered pulp heroes of the day. And it starts with Doc Savage, but it will include the Avenger, the white-faced Avenger, who you might remember from Shadow tie-ins and a few stories here and there in the DC universe when they had the license back in the day.
The Blackhawks
are in the book. Doc Savage, of course. Doc Savage is the closest thing you'll find to a Superman, but he is very human nonetheless.
Well, he's Doc Savage. Doc Savage was kind of the seed that Simon and Schuster used to build Superman.
Man of Bronze. Before there was a Man of Steel, there was a Man of Bronze who had a Fortress of Solitude.
You went to medical school.
That too. Hence, he was a doc. But
Superman has no degree.
But there's going to be a handful of DC Golden Age characters, like the Blackhawks will be represented. Black Canary's in the story. Wildcat's going to be in the story. Lima the Jungle Girl, who apparently was a 19th century South American female jungle hero. I got all this from Brian in a Word
With
Balloon interview.
With faithful Chupacabra. Chupacabra. We will get there.
Probably.
That was like a whole genre of comics back in the 40s and 50s was the Jungle Girl.
Oh, absolutely.
Comics.
Yeah, wow. Sheena and Jan.
I cannot understand why teenage young boys would be attracted to stories of wild jungle girls.
And yeah, and like leopard sarongs and stuff like that. Absolutely. No, I thought this was a very good start.
Me, Batman, you, Jane.
Did you like it, Chris? Did you like the story?
Yeah, I actually did. I read it twice because I had to get my head around. Okay,
I didn't understand.
This is like late 1930s or 1940s America. Here they are using cell phones, and there's guys with these are gangsters. Batman using guns.
I saw a movie recently. I can't figure out which one it was. Probably on DVD or something. I should have said that because I can't remember which movie it was, which was like that in this kind of intemporal 30s. That's what I call like intemporal 40s. Where they got like cell phones and all that. Yeah, it's very clearly stylized. Like you get a lot of Art Deco stuff, like huge cars with a hood that goes like forever.
I thought the Batman animated series kind of had that feel. I thought Dark City had that feel to it.
But often find it looks fake, except in the Batman animated series where it was absolutely assimilated in such a natural way that it were. I mean, like I'm talking about this series from the 90s. Like,
sure.
For me, that's the only one. Like that's really like the best of the best.
Because sometimes, I would agree. Sometimes it's a little bit like, I'm using a cell phone, and now there's a blimp in the background.
I haven't read that one, but like the art looks terrific.
Phil's awesome.
And
I'm a big Phil fan.
And something else. Originally, I have to admit, when I heard about it, I was like, why put Batman with like like Doc Savage? For me, Doc Savage is like he's his own guy. You know what I mean? He doesn't need the thing. For me, it's also back to Marvel had like a Doc Savage series, like drawn by Ross Andrew. A lot of issues, like which I loved when I was a kid.
I still remember those.
Oh, that was really great with his whole like crew, like with him.
And the five are in this. Will be in this series.
And also, quite frankly, the best take I've ever seen on Doc Savage was like his very short appearances, like thinly disguised in Planetary, like which I thought was really Dr. Brassballs whatever he was called.
Yeah,
like
Doc Brass, exactly.
Well, I mean, he's.
But enough people told me that this is really good, so I'm waiting for it to come like in the with Accomplice, and I'm sure I'll enjoy that.
I believe the series starts in February.
My
only problem with the art was I thought it was all a little light for what it was at times. At times it seemed like everything was really
too
like
bright.
Everything was really like bright at certain points, and like,
and it's a dark story. It's all at night.
It had a little. There was parts that just came across not as heavy as I thought.
Phil is a pretty unique artist. Not everyone is going to dig what Phil does.
I like what he does.
I love what he does. All those covers he did of Birds of Prey back in the early 2000s. He's got that paperback cover, and that's what I said to Brian.
He does have that feel. Absolutely. And also I find he's got like a good sense of design. Simply like see things work well, and like that's. You look at his pages and you can read it with confidence that you're going to get like a good storytelling. You're going to get into the story, basically.
He's a super nice guy.
And those old stories that they're based on, a lot of that pulp material from the 30s and 40s, it doesn't hold up well. I mean, it is dated. But back when I was a little kid, it's so funny. It's always the excuse I make for why we loved
1926 people.
Yeah, it's the truth. But yeah, growing up in the early 70s,
before the Depression,
this is all we had. I mean, so yeah, when those, as we were saying earlier, those comics that only came out 8 times a month when they weren't coming out, what were you reading? I read those Doc Savage paperbacks, the reprints and the Shadow reprints and the Adventure and stuff. And the characters were so cool. And also, DC flirted with those licenses back in the early 70s. You had Mike Caluta and Denny O'Neill writing and drawing the Shadow. Frank Robbins drew the Shadow for a while. Jack Kirby did several of those issues and Jack Kirby did a couple issues of the Avenger. Joe Orlando was kind of was the editor behind that end of the DC line. And there were some really neat pulp comics and everything, and that made me curious about the paperbacks. So yeah, I've kind of been waiting for great New stories for Doc and the adventure and stuff. It's been a long time.
I could be wrong, but yeah, I was about to mention Kyle Baker, Andy Helfer, yes, and like all these guys.
Yep.
That's the last time I think we've seen like maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me the last time we've seen like all these like great pulp characters like in a, published by a major company.
By a major company, because yeah. I know Mike Waringo did, and when we did our Word Balloon, we talked about it. He did a Doc Savage miniseries for, and I can't even remember, like Millennium Comics or something like that.
I should read that. I love his art. I mean,
yeah.
He's such
he was
a
embarrassed
great,
by, but you know, Mike was always embarrassed by great things that he did, and it wasn't a great Waringo, but it was solid,
I think,
and it was still
it's
cool.
One of the greatest loss
absolutely.
Of this business.
Absolutely,
it's
no, great
so
guy.
So sad. It's just unbelievable. It's like a great artist.
A marvelous artist, yeah. Absolutely.
Now, you growing up in France, do you guys have exposure to the great pulp heroes like the Shadow and Doc Savage? And
yeah, did the American pulps make it to France?
Yeah, yeah, the same way people have it here. You have to understand, like, when you grow up in another country, you basically are smarter than an American. Meaning, meaning you get everything Americans get, plus you get whatever they don't get from your own country and all that. I mean, we know, like, same as the States.
So you're saying you get all the American stuff and then you get all the cheaper European knockoffs of the American stuff.
We get like the high quality European stuff and then we get like the crap you guys like let us have, you know, like they're just like...
There was a pulp, a French pulp
I'll
hero.
I'll get you, Nissan.
Wasn't there a it started with an F.
Dr. Beret.
Fantomas.
Yes, Fantomas.
Fantomas.
Yes, and wasn't he kind of a pulp hero?
Yeah, absolutely.
A French pulp hero?
Yeah, there were novels. I mean, but
yeah,
what you guys would have called pulp. There was a huge wave in France, specifically like late 19th century, early 20th century. We had like also a great character called Arsène Lupin.
The detective,
which,
absolutely.
No, actually, he's a gentleman thief.
Ah, excuse me.
And it was a kind of like... almost an answer to Sherlock Holmes and some really wonderful novels. I used to love these when I was a kid. Everybody's read them like at some point.
And
like,
he's in the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. He makes an appearance in the second volume.
Well, I'm not surprised. He even had like a nemesis called Sherlock Holmes. So, you know, that's true. Yeah, yeah. But the stories, there was also the Fantomas you mentioned, like was very dark stuff. And we're talking about like that Paris at the turn of the 20th century, which is a very dark and mysterious Paris. You have the catacombs under Paris. You get like all that stuff. Like, and the atmosphere is very heavy. As a child, it was scaring me. Actually, you know, that
really?
Was like there was a kind of like heavy feel of like almost like a horror never seen, but like just right there, right under the surface. You know, like something quite scary. In the same vein, I'm just going to digress just for a second. One of the finest comic book artists we have in France, named Jacques Tardy. Was not known here. A few years ago, did a comic book adaptation of like the voice of the people, the cry of the people, which is a story about like the French Commune. The Commune was a French Revolution that happened like in the 1870s, like back in Paris, only like where the army killed people. Basically, the people were like revolting against like the restored like basically empire like of Napoleon III, and the army shot and killed the people. And he shows in this comic, because he's an extraordinary artist, he's the only guy who knows how to draw Paris and France, but like the feel is there, the buildings are real, and the way they looked then, he knows. I mean, it's I can't explain. Let me just say it's absolutely wonderful, and you get that same feel except from an almost like documentary point of view, if such a thing is possible, of this like really dark Paris, a Paris of ghettos, a Paris of real armed gangs that would like, you know, like just like cut your throat, like rip your eyes out and all that, where like several worlds are like colliding together, like several strata of society, like in a very oppressive and impressive way. That's
is this Jazz Age Paris, 1920s? You say
no,
Paris,
no, we're no. This is like 1870s.
Oh, okay, okay. Oh,
but,
okay.
But from there to I think the Commune, that revolution ended in was in 71. Unless oh god, I don't even know my history properly. 70 or 71?
Okay,
18. And from there, it seems to the 20s, you get this whole mysterious Paris thing going on, like in pulp, like a lot of novels come out, a lot of... So that I guess that would be French pulp.
Sure.
But okay. At the same time, we read also like Doc Savage, like, you know, obviously like stuff like Sherlock Holmes, British, but right. you know what, well, I mean. Like
and,
the same.
And it's Lupin and Holmes were more part of that period right before the dime novels of the early 1900s.
Yeah.
And it really went from, yes, like Lupin and Holmes in the late 19th century, the dime novels, which was like Nick Carter and people like that, all by Street and Smith. And then by the 30s, you had, you know, The Shadow, and
that's,
The Avenger that's was the literally the tail end, yeah, of the pulps.
I mean, I am not surprised, you know, like to see like some of these characters come into comics. I think maybe it should be someone in France should think the, should do the same, like with the ones we have, because there's a direct linkage from pulp fiction to comics. It's quite obvious.
These are the grandfathers of these characters. Yeah. Absolutely.
The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, it just makes sense. You know, it's certainly just like. And there's also a big, like, it seems to me, like, especially in the States, but maybe a little, also in Europe, I don't know, I'm not sure. There is a kind of yearning for that, like, Victorian sci-fi, if I can
steampunk.
Call it that way.
Yeah, steampunk.
Yeah, that's. Yeah. It's a whole genre in its own. And
oh, absolutely.
It works well.
Did you ever watch that Secret World of Jules Verne? That you were here when it was on in the 90s in the Sci-Fi Channel. And I mean, it wasn't a perfect show, but from a visual standpoint, it was absolutely League of Extraordinary Gentlemen beautiful.
I never saw that. But I read like about half his books, which is probably 30 books.
Jules Verne's books.
Yeah. Yeah. And in some ways, he probably is like the granddaddy. Him and, although no, he came before
Wells.
Verne came before Wells.
Yeah, yeah.
But he probably is the granddaddy of things. You know, it's like also this age where like the Eiffel Tower you get like that whole design, you know, like thing going on.
Yeah,
like
it was a futuristic design, absolutely, for its time.
That's,
certainly. Well, and also the, you know, and I think Alan Moore does cop to it. Philip Jose Farmer, a science fiction writer, yes, of the 60s, 70s,
excellent,
and 80s, who just passed away in the last couple of years.
I did not know that.
Yeah, and in like the last year or two, he had what he called the Wold Newton universe, and he kind of put a continuity to all of these characters who were written by individual writers and publishers, but he kind of connected them all together. And it
guys who just had to make everything fit.
It's well, and it does, and it's wonderful.
Comic book writers, they used to that. You know, it's like, how do you fix like the DC continuity? You know, these guys are like wired up to do that. It's like, wait a minute, how come like you know, like soon they're gonna like
it's
include, I don't know, like Crime and Punishment has to fit with like the latest, you know, like a sci-fi novel, and they're like,
it
how
does.
Do they make that work?
They make it work.
How did the Hardy Boys fit with Anna Karenina?
Yeah,
how are we gonna get those?
You know, and that's the great
thing.
I got
a few ideas about that one. Yeah,
if you go to Philip Jose Farmer's website, and there's still one there that you know kind of celebrates his work, there is a Wold Newton universe portion, and literally there is fan fiction that explains the connections of Shang-Chi to Sherlock Holmes by way of James Bond, and you know, really does put a familial continuity and says this person married this person who went to Shanghai, who met up with Fu Manchu, and there's Shang-Chi, and it's wonderful. And honestly, any comic book fan would love it. And they do connect the comic book characters.
Comic book writers are very attracted by definition to science fiction. Most
of
comic books are science fiction.
Absolutely.
That's what the superhero genre is. It's a kind of like a
mythology meets science fiction, basically.
Yeah, that's. And so they go back, like, obviously, to the, it seems like we have cut, it's simplistic, but, like, the science fiction age is at, like, 60s, 70s, which is the last wave of sci-fi in some ways. Before that, you have, like, the great sci-fi of the 30s, the way the 30s we used to imagine the world. You have Metropolis by Fritz Lang, the World Fair, that's part of this
True.
Whole, like, thing. And then you go back to what we were talking about, Jules Verne and all that. And they've all like dwelled into that stuff. Yeah, I don't know if it's correct to say that, but they all like
they pull from those worlds. Yeah.
Now, what would be interesting and would be because Jules Verne is not like the birth of science fiction. Obviously, I would like to see someone have a take on like Leonardo da Vinci's science fiction. The only time it's been done, as far as I know, it's like in the movie Flesh and Blood. That's
well, I do know and heard about this week. I don't know if you guys heard about it, but finally it's come out. Jonathan Hickman's got a very interesting 2010 series coming out in terms of the birth of S.H.I.E.L.D. and really looking at the history of S.H.I.E.L.D., which apparently does go back hundreds of years.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
We're going to see a very early in feudal China or Japan, I can't tell depending on the art, but a very early Galactus coming to Earth and dealing with somebody hundreds of years ago, or that apparently awesome. Da Vinci was an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.
You see, S.H.I.E.L.D.
And I think that's going to be – yeah, honestly, man, and the art looks fantastic, and John has told me about the series for months. And I've been thrilled about it and just waiting for it to finally come out in the public.
It sounds interesting, except for me, S.H.I.E.L.D. is too much like CIA. Like, in other words, it should have been, they should have put the roots of S.H.I.E.L.D. at the end of World War II, created by a Nazi, the same way the CIA was with Gehlen, who is the one who organized the CIA. It was modeled after like Hitler's, like
the SS.
Information, the SS. Like,
yes, yes.
Gehlen was like.
Well, there was the US.
Took him under his wing.
That's and, like, true. That's, but it, well, though, S.H.I.E.L.D. did, you know, was formed by the United Nations, supposedly. So, I mean, you know, really, the first Nick Fury S.H.I.E.L.D. story is in the helicarrier, and it is the United Nations that creates S.H.I.E.L.D.
How can the early carrier work anyway with such small propellers? Can anyone explain that to me?
It's Da Vinci. It's Da Vinci.
It's the best.
It's Da Vinci.
Right, exactly.
There
I'm sure Da Vinci. Would that be... Oh, man, exactly.
Thomas.
God.
Thomas
John, put that scene in if it's not already
together.
In.
All right,
somebody
guys.
Call Hickman.
I tell you what, let's wrap this one up. It's been a...
Already? Wow. Yeah. Well, you know how long it took me to get here?
Don't worry. We will soak you stay. For as long as we can today, so don't worry.
All right.
You have more talking left in you. All right, remember to check out John on Word Balloon.
Oh, thank you.
Yep. And Tom on Tom versus the Flash.
Yeah.
I'll pop up later in the week on 11 o'clock comics.
Yes, you will.
Christian, you are, of course, monthly on Green Lantern. 49, you and Doug.
Skipped.
You are skipping that
I
month?
I believe Ed Benes does the artwork for 49, and we'll be back with 50.
Which is going to be an oversized...
I believe it's going to be 30 pages. I'm not sure yet if there's like maybe 31, 32, something like that.
So it's oversized anniversary issue for 50.
50th issue, yep. Green Lantern, Blackest Night, the whole thing, like millions of dollars for me, like, you know.
in royalties.
A gold ticker tape parade. Like
he's wearing a luxurious coat right now.
Right
like
now.
His
very
next Elvis coat.
Like,
we were
talking
white
before,
leather.
Beforehand, you know, all of those.
I'm going to finally be able to import hair implants.
He'll show up with just the flowing locks.
You know,
hair.
All you folks that have been picking up the lantern rings at the store
all
each week. Well, Christian's rings work.
No, it doesn't. I'm just writing. The first one I got was like the black ring, and I figured, okay, if I can order it to ink instead of me, I mean, business right there.
Didn't work. Huh?
Well,
the
Everest
one
works,
but they are crap. They don't work. Then I tried flight, but because I'm very smart, I only climbed on a very small stool and jumped and told the ring, fly.
That's because you were afraid.
It didn't work. I was like, thank God I'm smart.
That's
otherwise,
right.
You know, like,
no, you had not enough will. It was
too much
not
fear.
Not enough will. What are you talking about? When it comes to make money, like have somebody work instead of me. I got all the will in the, all the will in the world, buddy.
You got to use the orange one then if you're going to use greed.
That's true too.
Yeah, that's the orange.
Right.
The orange one is the only ring that works.
I just got it today.
For me.
Maybe I go home and I'll try.
Is that the Doom Patrol issue?
Oh,
I forget that too.
All right, remember to drop the show an email at info@aroundcomics.com, and you can give us a shout on the voicemail line at 1-888-977-5903. All right, we'd like to thank everyone for joining us today. Tom and John.
Thank you.
And Christian.
Happy holidays.
And the fine folks here at Challengers Comics and Conversation for
yes,
hosting us.
Thank you,
yes,
Senor.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you, Del.
Yes, Mr. Patrick. So if you are ever in the Chicago area or if you live in Chicago, make sure to head down to Challengers Comics. They are located at 1845 Northwestern Avenue, just one, not even a full block south of the Western stop on the Blue Line. So, all right, everyone, have a fantastic rest of your week and weekend. We'll be back again next Monday with another full-length episode. In the meantime.
In between time.
Thank you.
I'll miss you, Chris.
I'll miss you, too. We'll be everywhere in.
And around
comics.
Chris's tiny arms.
Hey, it's a hockey
but
sweater.
Very strong and hairy.
Like a T-Rex. He's a scavenger.
He is like T-Rex.
Nice.
V. views expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Any reproduction, rebroadcast, or retransmission without the express written consent of Around Comics is strictly prohibited. All content presented in this program is the sole property of Around Comics, and this has been an Around Comics production, copyright 2009.